pals o' mine. Like lots of you folks, Pandora is my go-to when I need a change up of mood music for whatever's going on, cleaning, creating, working. This week I've been organizing and scanning photographs and documents for a client, and I could not find a Pandora station that didn't irritate me, which is highly unusual, by the way. So I looked online for something that just had nature sounds, and I stumbled on this really interesting site where you can adjust the nature sounds that they offer. Forest, rain, fire, frogs. You choose to listen to just one or a combination of the sounds, sliding up the bar from zero in each category. So like the rain choices, which is my favorite, thunderstorm or rain on a roof. It's really cool. Even the URL address is different. Nature sounds for me. Now what makes it different is it's nature sounds for .me. Anyway, I've bookmarked that page. Now for some, the sounds of an engine revving up is a blissful ambiance, especially for those for whom classic cars are a passion. What's lovely about classic car shows is that they often accompany fundraisers. And this particular one I attended, hosted by the Mean Machines Car Club, was promoting Toys for Tots. And let's face it, classic cars are toys for grown-ups, so it was a perfect fit. I spoke with some of the folk who had cars there, but unfortunately, my recorder is so sensitive, it recorded a breeze I wasn't even aware of. And no, I didn't have the windscreen or the muffler, stupid me. The recording is really horrible and unusable, and I am so sorry to those that I spoke to because I loved your stories. And I loved how many wives and girlfriends are incredibly involved with their other half's passion. And yes, there were women that were competing with some of the guys. So, again, I really apologize. So instead, I've had to punt for this week's podcast. Staying on the topic of classic, here's an excerpt of a conversation I had with Ron Harrison, who shared some insight into becoming a DJ on the spot in the 1950s.
Go by myself and listen to it at night. And they were KFBK, Sacramento, KEX, Portland, KHSL, Salt Lake City, very powerful stations. And I could get them at night, and so I'd listen to their programs, what they had to say, and so forth. And I think that would be the greatest job in the world. And my dream job, I thought, would be to get a job someday where I could be the announcer that would say, and now it's the Steve Allen Show, brought to you by Campbell's Soup. And I thought if I could do something like that, that would be nirvana. I would be, life was good. And so to get in this direction, I went to college, and I was had completed 3 years majoring in radio television. And I had been working at a lumber plant in Fort Bragg in the summertime. And in 1955, I was about to do the same thing. My dad got me a job each summer, which was good, helped pay the bills for college. But before I started to work in 1955, someone told me that there had been on the local radio station, KDAC, which called itself the Radio Voice of the Mendocino Coast, that someone working there had just left, which meant that there was an opening. It wasn't advertised around town, but someone just knew that someone left. So I said, wait a minute, who knows? This could be a chance. Let me go up there at least and talk to him. And so I went up to the radio station and told him I heard someone left and I'd like to get the job if I could. I was only 20 years old, never worked in a radio station before, and so they kind of looked at me and said, well, I don't know. I told them I was going to college. They said, well, if you did get the job, we don't want to hire anybody that's going to work here for 3 months and be gone. You'd have to promise at least to be here a year, assuming you might get the job. I said, for a year, I would do it. It'd be like an internship, and I was getting tired of school by that time anyway. So they said, okay, here's the first thing we have to do then. We should read some commercials and read a little news and just see how you sound and how you do that part, which I was pretty confident in because I'd taken, classes in oral interpretation and that thing. And it was the kind of thing that I just happened to be kind of good at anyway. So that part, I passed, no problem. Then, since it was a small station, when you were the announcer on duty, you also had to run the entire board. You had to be your own engineer, which means all the switches and all the gauges and everything had to be done and putting the records on in those days. You had to put them on turntables. The only tape we had was a big wall-mounted reel-to-reel tape. So you had separate consoles for the different albums. You could put LPs on this one, LPs on the second LP, and you have to have them all queued up. And all this thing had to run and be coordinated, and you had to run. But they call ride the gain, so they weren't coming up too loud or too low, so the sound was not affected going out of the airwaves. So they asked me if I had any board experience. And of course I had zero. I had never even seen one. But I cheated, let's just say I lied totally by saying, I've taken some of that in college. I don't remember, I'm not really totally, greatly up to speed on it. And he said, well, what kind did you work with? What was the brand, manufacturer's name? And I went, well, gee, what was it? I'm not sure. They said, well, maybe it was RCA. I said, yeah, RCA, that sounds like it's a little familiar. And they said, well, tell you what, we liked the way you sound and everything, and so we'll hire you for the job. And you also, by the way, we also want you to write commercials. Could you do that? I said, well, I did take a couple of journalism classes, and yeah, I think I could do that. They said, okay. So now they said, okay, you can start Monday, and this is Friday. And they said, but since you need to familiarize yourself a little bit with all of the board equipment, go up, if you could, even this evening, and sit in as much of the weekend as you want with the announcer on duty, and have him point out the differences to you so that when Monday comes, you'd be able to do this. And I said, well, okay. And I go out there, and I look at all these dials and gauges and flips and switches, and I go, my God, what is this? And the announcer, a nice guy on duty, said, well, how does this look different from what you've seen? Any questions you want to ask me about any differences? And I said, well, let's do this. I think the easiest way, rather than have me ask you a lot of questions, why don't you, you're just sitting there, and every time you do something, tell me exactly what you're doing it and how you're doing it, and I'll just try to study hard. So he said, well, okay, first here's a switch for the mic. This is up, this is off, this is in the middle, this is neutral, this is for a mic for another booth that's on the other side, and this lever is this turntable, and that's this turntable, and here's how you cue it up. You do this, then you back it off a little bit, and it's ready to go, because he said it was you wouldn't do ideally. He must have known that maybe I didn't know a whole lot. He said, when you flip the switch for that turntable, it should make one complete revolution, and boom, the sound should come right in. He says, the last thing that the manager of the station wants to hear, or not hear, is dead air. When you finish saying it, now it's time for the song, here's Bing Crosby, boom, it should be right there, not a gap of a second or 2 seconds of dead air. That's the goal. That's the supreme goal. It's okay, yeah, right, here's this turntable over here, here's the tape. And over here, we had a file, folder file, for all the commercials that have to be read. And here is, and also another list, hanging down there was every time that a commercial is supposed to be given. Might say 203. Golden Rule Market. Then you had to look over here alphabetically because nothing's pre-taped. You have to pick out the Golden Rule Market, read that commercial, put it back in from the Associated Press, a variety of news, and every hour they would have a 5-minute summary of news. And so you would zip off into this room while the record's playing, tear off the 5-minute news summary, zip back, never having a chance to read it ahead of time, sit back, and then pop it on, and then say, time now for 5 minutes of late world news from the wires of KDAC and the Associated Press newsroom, like it was a big operation. And, Ron Harrison reporting, and so you had to do that. And sometimes because you didn't get a chance to read it ahead of time, you're looking a little bit ahead because you learned to read ahead a little bit, and then you'll see some Russian name or something. You go, my God, what is that? But then one of my coworkers told me, don't worry about it, because if you've never seen it before, probably no one in the audience has heard it before, and they haven't seen it either. So just fake it as best you can, and you'll then become the authority for the way that name should be pronounced, even though they had the phonetics behind it. Sometimes it's harder to figure out the phonetics than it is just to read the name. Or worse than that, as you're reading down, you see that for some reason, the machine garbled about 3/4 of the way through, and you look down, all you got is garble coming up. You're not even going to have the full 5 minutes. So you've got to had to adjust and ad-lib to fill in for that if it would happen. But anyway, I sweated through that first weekend. I was there. I must have been there virtually every hour of that weekend. Then when I got to work and then started to do my shift or partial shift on Monday, I was still, the sweat was pouring off my body. And I knew it felt like each song, because the song was on, we had to do things, remember, like go find the commercial, find where it is, pull it out, get ready to read it, and also have another song queued up to go right behind the one you just played. And that song would be over, it seemed like it's 6 seconds. And I couldn't barely get them fast enough, and I would get behind things, and I'd have to ad-lib stuff, and I was losing my train of thought. And so I was sweating for a while. But after a week or 2 weeks, pretty soon, I got into the flow of things. And then it was really cool. I mean, then I could put a record on, and I had a chair that had wheels on it, and we had the library, all the records behind us. I would just give a push with my feet, send my chairs sliding backwards, knew about where I was going, boom, reach in, get a record, zing, back, have this one queued up, be talking the phone to somebody else, I do it over the, with the earphones, cue the record up, and it's ready to go, I'm talking to somebody in the phone, so I had to answer the phone inside there as well. Yet there was after hours, we had regular office hours, but if the office wasn't open, then I had to answer the phone as well. And so it was great, because for one thing, in 1955, 56 is which when I worked there, that was an all-purpose station. Because at that time, in those days, you did not have, like, one radio station that was, like, all country or all rock and roll or all something else. There was something for everybody. This was a, you know, one-size-fits-all radio station. So we would have, in the morning, we would have a lady that would come in. Her name was Eloise, the sweetest voice in the world. Homeless lady you ever saw, but she sounded so beautiful, and she'd give home hints, and then we'd have another morning show of general music, and we had another in the afternoon, I forget what it was called, something like Club 1230, because that's where we were on that radio dial, it's 1230, where we just played general music. And what was terrific about that is, since we did not have any playlists, like a lot of places have right now, an arranged playlist picked out way ahead of time, they have a program manager who picks them all out, and you have you know, little, if any, choice. I could pick out anything that I wanted to play. And so if I had seen a movie or an older movie and there's some songs that I wanted to hear, I'd play those. I had an artist I like, I'd play that person, and no one ever criticized you know, what I did. And so it was like, in a way, for a few hours every day, like being home, playing your favorite music and getting paid for it. So you couldn't beat it. And we had and one program that we did have was called the Bar Nothing Ranch. And that was from 11:30 in the morning until 1:30 in the afternoon. And it was all requests and dedications. And people would call in and they request, and they'd dedicate it to somebody. And it was called the Bar Nothing Ranch, because we didn't bar anything. Whatever song you request and dedicated, we'd play it. Just so happened that on the Mendocino Coast at the time, country music seemed to be what everybody was requesting. At least 80% of it was country music. And up till that time, I thought country music was Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, and the Sons of the Pioneers. That's all I ever heard. And all of the other hardcore country music, we kind of, you know, looked askance at. It was hillbilly music or Okie music or whatever. But the more I played it, the more I listened to it, I got to like it more and more until it became one of my favorite types of music, which I listen to all the time now. Old names then, it was Webb Pierce and Lefty Frizzell and I don't remember who all, but they were the stalwarts of what's now known as traditional country honky-tonk music, steel guitars, and they certainly were unique. Voice is like Webb Pierce, a lot of nasal inflections, and played a lot of dedications, played those, and since there were three of us that would host that, because it was on every day of the week, we all had our own Western nicknames, and mine was Ranch House Ron, a nickname that has stuck with me to this day, and a lot of my friends, they heard about that, and a lot of times they say, hey, Ranch House, hey, Ranch, come over here, and my license plates, my wife even put those as R-N-C-H-H-S for me, so it was a fun time, and also something that I was able to do, I would dedicate some songs to my girlfriend at the time, but I would not use her real name to keep things, you know, confidential or something. I don't know why. Although she did later become my wife. But I could, you know, dedicate some romantic song to her without anybody saying, oh, look who you're dedicating a song to. And so that was all fun. And I also wrote a lot of commercials. And I thought I got, you know, pretty good at writing them the precise length, because we either had a 30-second commercial, 20-second commercial, or a 1-minute commercial. And I also got, I think, pretty good at reading these newscasts, especially when you had to be adept, as I've already explained, on making some corrections. So we were busy, but we also were relaxed a little bit at the same time. In fact, one of the guys I worked with, his name was Don. He's a good-looking single guy. And to show you how kind of informal we were to a great extent, one afternoon he thought it was time to wash his car, so he put on a long-playing record and says, now we're going to hear Three in a Row by whoever. Puts that on. Zips out the front door, proceeds to wash his car. Well, unknowns to him, about halfway to the first record, he gets stuck. It's going, nidate, 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 totally unaware of it, because he was just watching his wristwatch for the time to go by for three records. And calls are coming in, the manager comes in, calls him, and he got in somewhat a bit of trouble for doing that. But that's, you know, it was kind of relaxed, small town stuff. But it's probably one of the greatest jobs I had, because it was right in the area of what I wanted to do. I'm like 20 years old, getting paid for playing music and talking and reading things. And I did that, for a full year, and then completed college and got my degree in television, radio and TV, business administration combo. And then actually went to work at a TV station for a couple of years. And then doing that, said, well, this is a risky business. You got to travel all over the country. I think I'll go to law school instead and use my vocal abilities and everything that I've learned in radio and TV to tell persuasive stories to juries. So I did that as a trial attorney for about 34 years, and it's been a wonderful life.
In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to the 5,300 square mile National Coal Heritage Area in southern West Virginia. The National Coal Heritage is a unique cultural region where coal mining made a significant contribution to the national story of industrialization. Situated in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains, it encompasses 13 counties. This beautiful, picturesque country has a rich history of families, communities, and a violent past. The West Virginia Mine Wars culminated in the nation's largest armed uprising since the Civil War. The United Mine Workers of America, UMWA, was formed in 1890, 10 years after West Virginia miners first went on strike. In response, mine companies laid off miners and closed mines. This is from the Coal Heritage website. In April 1912, miners along Paint Creek in Kanawha County walked off the job, demanding higher wages, the right to organize, and an end to the hated mine guard system. They were joined shortly by miners from nearby Cabin Creek. Due to continuing violence, Governor William Glasscock declared martial law and dispatched the National Guard to restore order three times. In 1913, new Governor Henry Hatfield essentially dictated a resolution to the strike, meeting few of the miners' demands. Miners, National Guard troops, and the company's mine guards set up camps and fought pitched battles for more than a year. The most notorious event occurred when mine guards shot blindly into a miner's tent colony, killing a man. A shootout at Mattawan in 1920 started a war that raged between coal operators and the UMWA in Mingo and McDowell counties for more than a year. On August 1st, 1921, Sid Hatfield, the Union hero of the Mattawan Massacre, was killed by company hired detectives. UMWA leaders provoked outraged miners to march on Mingo County in an attempt to force coal operators to accept the Union, at gunpoint if necessary. On August 24th, 5,000 armed miners began marching from Marmot just outside Charleston. Standing between the marchers and Mingo County was Blair Mountain, a rugged mountain that guards the town of Logan. Logan County Sheriff Don Chafin gathered troops and established fortifications atop a high ridge on the mountain. The first shooting occurred at Sharples on August 27th and soon escalated into a full-scale battle. On September 1st, President Warren Harding dispatched U.S. Army troops to the region. 2 days later, the miners began surrendering. When the fighting ended, at least 16 men, including 12 miners, had been killed. Blair Mountain was the last major battle of the Southern West Virginia Mine Wars. President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal finally turned the tide and allowed the UMWA to organize Mingo, McDowell, and other counties in 1933. The UMWA's newfound success gave the Union extraordinary political power, choosing and electing congressmen, legislators, and governors. The UMWA-supported Democratic Party has controlled the state legislature since Roosevelt was first elected in 1932. The UMWA's membership dropped in the 1950s and 60s as mining jobs disappeared. Today, its membership is about one-half of its peak number in 1946. However, the numbers have declined far less dramatically than the drop in mining jobs. It's powerful stuff. There were bright days, however, such as coal camp baseball. This area doesn't have a lot of flat land, so where it does exist, that's where a ball field was located. Charles Stubby Say was a miner who went on to play professional baseball, but returned to the mines because digging coal was more lucrative than professional baseball. A little different than today. The National Coal Heritage Area offers a plethora of interesting sites regarding coal mining history, but there are other options too numerous to mention here. If you plan on visiting southern West Virginia, enjoy the beautiful countryside and learn a little of this country's history at the same time. Do something different. If your family exchanges gifts for the holidays, have fun with it and pick a theme, like the ocean or sports or a color.